Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
You just said our enemies in Iraq. Did Iraq attack us?
No, I'm saying Al-Qaeda.
Okay, did Iraq attack us, Elizabeth?
Iraq did not attack us,
Correct.
Rosie. We've been there before. Well, I'm saying our enemies, Al-Qaeda. Are you hearing that?
I hear it, but where do you want to go, bub?
This we're going to political discussion. Don't interview each other. Just say what you mean.
If you're playing a game, okay? If you're playing a game, and I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to throw to my wide receiver, wide right, okay? Do you do that? I'm going to do it in 2 seconds. What does that do for your enemy?
Well, you know what, Elizabeth? If the enemy are innocent civilians, I don't want to play that kind of football.
The enemy are not innocent.
A specialist in American political opinion, voting behavior, and city politics, Doug Muzio has had extensive political, governmental, and media experience. He is founder, former director, and current chief pollster at Baruch College Survey Research at CUNY, City University of New York, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to our discussion this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking a lot about civility and skirting around the issue of civility in politics. Where do you feel we are now when it comes to civility and incivility? Because when in the public forums that we have had, people have said that the behavior we are seeing is deplorable and they aren't going to A, stand for it, or B, go anywhere near it.
Nonsense. The same argument against negative campaigning. We hate it. They shouldn't do it, but we absorb it, we listen to it, and we act on it. So clearly, the reaction to what many see as the vulgarization of politics is real. The level of discourse has been lowered in part for any number of reasons. One is the media, the 24/7 cycle, the need for drama, the need for conflict, the need to feed the beast. And talk radio has added to that. So you have this din out there. And to get the most attention, you have to be the most outrageous. And the way to be outrageous is to be rude, impolite, uncivil.
And so the language that we often use is hearkening back to using slave terms or using of likening someone to Hitler or to a Nazi. So we go and we try to be outrageous in what we are saying to these individuals.
Absolutely. And it's not only to attract eyeballs or, you know, ears. It is an expression of emotion. There is a reality to the emotion. It's not only the content of speech that's important, but the form of speech. And to regulate the form of speech, as has been attempted legislatively in several states, is a mistake because emotions are important. The means of expression is important. And the Supreme Court, in a number of decisions, particularly the Cohen decision in 1971, argues that just because it's insulting, just because it's disturbing, doesn't mean it's not protected speech. And I think there's a role for incivility. There are times, for example, when incivility is not only appropriate, but it's necessary. I'm a child of the 60s, and I believe that the incivility of the protesters, the use of harsh language, vulgarities, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? There's a real need for the ability to express emotion. It can become destructive, though. Clearly, oftentimes, our politics becomes ensnared by the language that we use. But also, the language that we use, in part, is a means not to talk about issues. And the incivility that we see is both a necessary concomitant of a democracy. You need it. As Madison points out in Federalist 10, it's part of the very air that we breathe. It's part of our liberty. It's part of our fundamental rights to be rude, impolite, and incivil.
But what happens if it stops everything? So you're not going to move, I'm not going to move, and God forbid either of us take a step.
Well, that's exactly the problem. You run into this deadlock, and it's not only deadlock. It's loud, shouting deadlock. It's a deafness that comes from the shouting because you can't hear the other side over the din of your own voice. And once that dialogue breaks down and it becomes simply epithets back and forth and a lack of comprehension where you're really talking past one another, that's dangerous. When that consensus to at least in some sense rationally discuss breaks down, then you've got a problem.
So let's go back to the start of our conversation. You think we love it. You think we love this going back
kidding?
And forth.
Of course we love it. We love point counterpoint. We love Saturday Night Live. This shows show you my age. You know, Jane, you ignorant slut.
Dan, there's an old saying. Behind every successful man, there's a woman. A loving, giving, caring woman. But you wouldn't know about that, Dan, because there's no old saying about what's behind a miserable failure.
Jane, you ignorant slut. Bagged out, dried up, slunk meat like you and Michelle Triola know the rules. If you want a contract, sign on the dotted line. Oh, but let's all shed a tear for poor Michelle Triola. There was only testimony that she had sexual intercourse over 40 times with another man while living with actor Lee Marvin. But I suppose that sort of fashionable promiscuity means nothing to someone like you, Jane, who hops from bed to bed with the frequency of a cheap ham radio. But hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and Michelle Triola, like a screeching, squealing, rapacious swamp sow, is after actor Lee Marvin's last $3 million. I guess what you and Michelle are saying is that when you're on your backs, the meter is running. Well, please spare us, gals, and tell us the rates at the top. Then we can choose which two-bit tarts and bargain basement sluts to shack up with.
I mean, that whole notion of conflict, point, counterpoint, has become endemic. It's part of the fabric of our political discourse, and it is both positive in some senses, but it's also negative and destructive in others.
So if I want to work something out with you, is it not better to say, Doug, can we talk about this as to here are my problems with what you're saying, you tell me the problems you have, and is it possible to find
common
ground?
It's too rational. I don't want to talk to you. You're wrong. I'm right. I have a corner on truth, and you are part of the unenlightened. You are a heretic. You don't deserve to be in the conversation. That's the problem. This exclusion and the language and the form of the speech is exclusionary. It precludes the type of rational discourse that you're talking about. Let's sit down as reasonable people and lay out your concerns and your values and my concern and values, and somehow we will rationally discuss this and resolve it to our mutual satisfaction or something close. Bull. That's not the way it works. It works in terms of power. And there is power in words. There's a power in mobilizing people with words. So the language itself can be, it's mobilizing, but as it mobilizes us, it separates us from them.
So let me add another word to the vocabulary here. And instead of rational, let's talk about partisan and bipartisan. Is it possible to work in a bipartisan fashion and use the type of language that you just used?
I think it is. I think it is possible. It doesn't exist in current American political discourse. No, and I think we're moving away from that model of sincere, loyal opposition that has emotion, and it crosses that line where the positions are so hardened and the ideology so pervasive that the language is simply a weapon in a larger ideological political conflict.
You talk about how the problem really isn't civility or incivility, but a lack of responsible engagement. How do we gauge what is responsible engagement?
See, that's part of the problem, is that it's all based on values. So what's civility? What's incivility? What are the boundaries? It's really a very unclear concept. It's civility is more than common politeness, but politeness is part of civility. Civility simply, I think civility means what you defined it as, that people are willing to engage one another in a, I guess I have to use the word rational, meaning that I've got goals and I've got strategies, but I can explain these to you and let's see if we can come to an agreement, some kind of deliberative discussion rather than purely emotive discussions.
When it's just between us, I can understand that. But when it's just between us and it affects everyone out there, isn't there more of a responsibility on what we discuss?
Again, yes. I mean, my personal reaction is certainly that you have a responsibility, and public officials have a responsibility to constrain, to constrain their emotional appeals in some way with a rational dimension that allows at least for discussion, if not compromise. But it's becoming increasingly polarized, the discussion, that there ain't much of a twain there where we can meet. And there's an unwillingness to meet as well. It's not only the incapacity to meet, but it's also an unwillingness to confront, because in some sense, you're afraid that rational discourse and a full exploration of the issues will lead you to realize that you were wrong. And we don't want to admit we're wrong. So I think there's that element of it as well. Also, you have deep-grained values, religious values, cultural values, societal values, or regional values, or ethnic values, whatever those values are that structure the way we both look at the world and act within it. And that makes the discussion a little bit difficult, because whose values are we talking about? Again, going back, what is civil? What is incivility? What are the boundaries? Are there legal boundaries? Can we limit the content of ideas? Can we limit, and ought we limit, not only the content of ideas, but the form in which they come, the language within which they're spoken? I mean, ideas can be dangerous. And I believe in the marketplace of ideas. You know, let it out there and fight it out in the marketplace of ideas. That doesn't quite work, but at least that's the model where it should be. The marketplace is doing that, but it's doing it loudly, and it's not listening to the other sides.
It also doesn't seem to listen to the marketplace often. If the marketplace comes in and, let's say, voting, and someone is reelected by 82%, it would seem to me that the message would be, okay, what this person is saying and what they're doing is being approved by,
that's exactly right,
I mean, the majority of the people.
Right, and elections are the chief mechanism by which, I mean, we make those decisions about the appropriateness of behavior. So a candidate like Aiken can say outrageously stupid things about raping women, but he gets punished for it. So, I mean, yeah, there is a marketplace, and there is an ultimate decider in, you know, these things that we call elections.
I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier, which was, there's a negativity in the campaign. We like it, you say. We look for the red meat, and when the election's over, we want that all taken away, right?
Right, but those words leave scars. I mean, there's the mythology in American politics that the day after the election, we all come together and do kumbaya. It may appear like that in the immediate aftermath of the election, but those divisions remain. And it's up to political leadership to address those cleavages in a long-term view. There's a short-sightedness in much of American politics today. There is not this concern about the influence of what we're doing now on the future, because it's all short term. What do I gain from this politically? What do I gain from this strategically? And what do I gain from this personally? And there seems to be little consideration of the long range or even mid range societal consequences.
So as we wrap up, let's talk about consequences. So are we going to pay for this? Or are we paying for this?
I think we are paying for it. I think part of the quote-unquote dysfunction that we see in Washington and other state capitals is at least in part a product of the way we express our ideas as well as the conflict inherent in the ideas themselves. I mean, I believe in the Jagger Richards rule or the Rolling Stones rule. You can't always get what you want. And not being able to get what you want creates conflict. And conflict involves antagonisms at some level. And language is an important element. So red meat, if it excites a base and gets you elected, then you throw out the red meat. Or forget about being elected, or if you are a media outlet, you do as much drama, conflict, attack, response as possible because that engages viewers.
Are you optimistic about the future of when it comes to gridlock, when it comes to becoming less polarized? Do you think that will happen?
Looking at history, the answer is probably yes, because if they're not cycles, there are changes and inflection points. As of now, though, at least in my lifetime, post-war baby boom early, lived through the anti-war movement, etc., I would say in some ways we are more deeply cleaved as a society than any time since the Second World War, even including the cleavages brought on by Vietnam, etc. I think these are stark times, and we may be at a pivot point. Does this hold together, or does it really, do the centrifugal forces just spin out? And I have to tell you, I'm not unduly optimistic about it. I would have to say, looking at it now, I don't see our way out of it. Looking at 2014 elections, the 2016 lineups, I don't see this polarization, these cleavages, really being diminished.
Doug Muzio is founder, former director, and current chief pollster at Baruch College Survey Research at CUNY, City University of New York. Thank you very much for discussing with us this morning.
My pleasure.
Our series, Agreeing to Disagree, Civility in Public Discourse, will continue tomorrow with Part 2, Civility, Tolerance, and Expectations, featuring Professors Randall Kennedy, Arthur Miller, and Jonathan Haidt. This program is funded in part by Mass Humanities, state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, masshumanities.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.